Welcome everyone joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Bob, KD2NVB, will be my co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers, as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. We also offer original articles and reviews on many topics that are covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club's website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange colored type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, just type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. We also have an EchoLink node available for use. Just point your EchoLink application to the node kc2rc-r. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, which is www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. No question is too simple. No question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your first name, your call sign, whether you have a question or comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and Bob, KD2NVB, will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here on the technical net or via our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Bob, KD2NVB. Good evening, Bob.
Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everybody out there. So hope everybody's out there. Looking forward to an interesting net tonight.
As am I, so hopefully it will be quite interesting. I hope there'll be some people who will drop by and participate. So with that in mind, once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. So we're here if you have any questions or want to discuss a topic or have a comment to make about any kind of previous other comments or questions that were discussed on previous technical nets. So if you're out there and you have a question or a comment, please hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign. Well, it would appear that we have a kind of another slow start for another technical net. Not been the first or the 10th or probably the 20th. So hopefully it's just a matter of people who, it's 9 o'clock and they were doing something else, or they forgot that it's the fourth Wednesday of the month. So hopefully all of a sudden the bulb will light up and they'll turn their dial to 146.730, the Kings County Radio Club's repeater, and sit down and join us for a while. Once again, I am AC2GS. This is the Kings County Radio Club 10-meter technical net. I'm having flashbacks to another net that I do net control with. Anyway, it's the Kings County Radio Club technical net. If you have any technical questions or topics of discussion, please hit that push-to-talk button. Give us your first name and your call sign.
Quick question about how far a handy talkie can reach going up like a satellite.
Hello, Theodore. Well, it's a matter of line of sight. If you are in the line of sight of the satellite, you can hit it. It's not far enough away that the inverse square law is going to be much of a factor. It's more of it being in your line of sight. Unlike lower frequencies that can skip across the ionosphere, you know, 2 meters and such, and 70 centimeters, doesn't really have that much ionospheric propagation. It does have some degree of tropospheric ductal propagation. The troposphere is very close to the ground, and tropospheric ducting is the product of thermal inversions, where layers of moist air are inverted as far as temperature is concerned, and produces a local refractive zone just at the troposphere. But getting back to your question, the sky is the limit practically, as long as the satellite isn't ridiculously far away. It's just a matter of being line of sight with it.
So say if we were to raise a handy-talkie on, say in the park, and then point that up, would the signal be able to reach something that is in, like, say, on Mars?
Did you say Mars?
How far up?
Okay. When you tell me satellite, I unfortunately think of Earth-based satellites, the ISS, there are CubeSats, there are a bunch of things circling the Earth. If you're interested in extraterrestrial satellites, then the inverse square law is a big problem. Then you need a lot of power and a lot of directional antennas. NASA doesn't use a handy-talkie. NASA uses massive satellite systems all over the world linked together to maintain communications with spaceborne devices. So if you're talking about simple satellites that amateurs readily access, well, the most that you're going to need is a portable Yagi. There's a few companies that sell Yagis of different design that you could just wave about and point in the right direction, and you'll hit a local satellite. If you want to talk to Mars or outer space, unless you have the same budget that the JPL has, I don't think that you're going to be very successful.
Thanks very much. It was a miscommunication here. My main concern was like, okay, well, if something is directly above me and Earth is rotating, whatever's directly above me is going to change if we draw a straight line all the way out. But inverse square law will definitely apply, gain's going to apply, and then wattage was my main question. Like, well, how many watts do I need in order to send a signal, assuming that a satellite is going to transit from above me to not above me? Could I send out the signal before it actually arrives and then stop transmitting?
Well, again, I'm not quite sure what you're getting at. You got to realize that, of course, RF travels at the speed of light in a vacuum. So that's very, very fast. So there's nothing that I can think of locally where a handy-talkie is going to have the amount of power necessary to make contact that's going to be so far away that you have to factor in the latency errors of the speed of light. So for all intents and purposes, if you're trying, and people do this all the time, there are a whole bunch of AMSAT satellites. There is the ISS. And there's a whole bunch of guys who run around with handy-talkies and those portable Yagis. There are other guys who sit in the comfort of their shack, and they have azimuth controls on their Yagis pitched on the roof someplace. And they have a pretty ICOM 9700 to do most of the heavy lifting for them. But there's no real latency issue as far as the distances we're talking about that are possible for the average ham to contact people. You know, in the old days, guys mustered a lot of technology to do moon bounce. in order to do moon bounce, which is much higher than the satellites circling our planet, often they needed multiple arrays of Yagis. I've seen things like 3x9 arrays of Yagis clustered together and full legal power, and that for some CW signal retrieval reflecting back from the moon. Now, of course, Joe Taylor has digital algorithms, where you don't quite need that much power and you don't quite need that many Yagis, and you can bounce off the moon. But again, as far as satellites are concerned, I don't think latency issues with the speed of light is a problem. You basically, there are a lot of programs out there that tell you where the satellites are in relation to you and will tell you approximately where to point your Yagi. And sometimes some of these people are very adept at moving the Yagi as they hear the signal fading out, because it is a moving target.
Answer my question. Yeah, I initially wasn't really sure whether you're talking stuff that was very close to the Earth or very far from the Earth, and I was like, well, maybe I misunderstood. Definitely speed of light would come into effect for stuff that's further out from the planet. Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Theodore. Anytime you got a question, feel free to come by and share. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here to discuss technical questions or topics of interest. So if anyone is out there and interested in offering up a topic or a question, please hit that push-to-talk button and give me your first name.
AC2ZV. This is Alpha Charlie 2 Zulu Victor William checking in. Hi, Roy.
Yes. Hello, William. Welcome to the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. Do you have any questions tonight, or are you just checking in?
I have a couple of questions for you. I don't know if you know it, but right now is the annual NVIDIA conference that's just going on, and I've been looking at, you know, what they've been doing with compute and the amount of power and the new developments, and it is really like amazing what is going on. So I just wonder if you follow that or have any comment about what's going on.
Yeah, I haven't heard this week's specifics yet. I kind of decided to wait until I'd collect a whole bunch of YouTubes that will cover the topic and pre-digest it. There have been all kinds of amazing announcements regarding artificial intelligence over the last 2 weeks, and this seems to be continuing. Every day, some new update of some old product or brand new products. They've just started to bring out an artificial intelligence that can turn text into simulated video. And I understand that NVIDIA is the guys that make a lot of these inference engines that do a lot of the artificial intelligent processing, both training and functioning. So, their boards seem to be ubiquitous among the artificial intelligent guys working on this. So, it seems like every day is a new announcement, which is a great thing. It's a scary thing at sometimes, but a good thing. And of course, every single company that was talking about NFTs or cryptocurrency are now talking that they're going to slap artificial intelligence on it. So Google's going to go artificial intelligence, and Microsoft is going to go artificial intelligence. Everything is going to go. I'm waiting for a paint company to sell paint that's based on artificial intelligence.
Yeah, that's really, what's amazing to me is the way that the development is moving. The whole concept of the parallel worlds and then building, virtual warehouses and real warehouses with the same set of plans. And those kind of things, which are actually to begin with, because it starts with a draftsman having to actually lay out stuff on paper and machinists having to build it. And if you think about building a factory, a set of plans, at the same time being able to use that same plans to create a 3D virtual environment, and then you start saying, well, there's also other machines in this factory, and like various robots and moving equipment, and guess what, there's shelves and everything. Each of those all have drawings and specifications. And so it's amazing. You could just take all of that stuff and put it all together in this 3D thing, and then you can automate it. And then they have their avatars in there walking around inside it that actually are able to speak like you're over time. But the avatars that can speak, you know, like you're talking about. So I just have been imagining the craziest things. But it's just really coming strong because their factories must be producing these boards hand over fist.
Well, I don't think NVIDIA actually makes, fabricates the boards or fabricates the chip. I think it's TSMC. Like most companies, farm the really high level silicon out to them. But it's probably not as profitable, my guess would be, as generic 3D. Graphic processing units for personal computers. Each of those boards that we're talking about, they're much more sophisticated, cost thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. They sell a bunch of them, but probably a small fraction of what they sell to the personal computer market. But it's bleeding edge technology, nevertheless. It's capable of teraflops of operations, and it's kind of amazing that they're doing such advanced things when it comes to these types of boards. I don't know if you keep in tune with graphic processor devices, but NVIDIA did not really enthuse anyone with the 4000 series recently. They tend to gobble a great deal of power. They're enormous. And they generate a lot of waste heat that you have to deal with, to the point where it's really not that feasible to plug in a state-of-the-art NVIDIA board to an old machine because the power supply simply can't stand it. But as far as these lines of technology, it's going to improve the capability of all these other artificial intelligence developers, and that's always good to hear. They're also, the AI guys are working on smaller models that require less hardware, but are not that much slower than the expensive version. So technology is kind of advancing in all kinds of aspects of AI. And again, it's exciting to watch it happen. There's a little trepidation because I've watched The Terminator. I know how the movie ends. So I'm a little concerned, but the future marches on.
At your points, one of the interesting takeaways that I got out of it was that they are being able to accelerate the compute to such a high level that even though the board consumes more power, it actually delivers thousands times more teraflops. And so when you have actually compute operations, which are required, you know, which is transcoding video or doing daily job updates, night job updates in real time, being able to push databases and a lot of data processing, you know, speeds, then, you know, it's the price that you get is a lot of heat out of those things, but then they do things like so much more efficiently than 100 servers you could do with 10. Even though those 10 servers pull more power, they don't pull as much as 100, and so there's a net savings in terms of compute that you get for your dollar energy spend. So I think that's the kind of sales pitch I was getting today.
Okay. I mean, I don't know if they were really promoting the graphic processor boards or the really new technology. They've gotten a lot of kickback from a lot of people in the, you know, PC community who expected not as expensive boards and not as overpowered as far as the power requirements. The general consensus of the people buying these things is that NVIDIA unfortunately learned a bad lesson from the cryptocurrency people who bought up all their old GPUs in the past, and scarcity drove the price for cards to the stratosphere. They decided that the market could tolerate, a $1,200, $1,300, $1,400 graphic board. And I don't think the market can for the most part. So I think they're getting kickback from that.
I'll say, Roy, you certainly have a great and unique perspective on this stuff, because I get washed over by so much sales pitch all the time. And it's great to hear, you know, a little sandbag on the balloon that these guys put up all the time. But I'm still impressed with the technology. And the thing is that they're working at the data center level, which is like racks of servers and stuff. So I'm sure that as the average person maybe doesn't want to put one of those in their machine because you don't have that much compute to do, it might be much, you know, provide really great value for other people. And then you mentioned Bitcoin. And I'm thinking, oh, yeah, now I see what's driving the company, all these people buying more and more compute for their Bitcoin, which I think is a total waste of energy.
Well, by the way, AC2GS, I hate to veer into cryptocurrency, but just for a second, there's a few things affecting that. In the old days, say a year or two ago, the means to mint crypto coins utilize the abilities of graphic processor units. As time went on, it became less efficient because the cost for the board and maintaining the board and the power for the board kind of diminished the profit margin. They moved to something called ASIC, A-S-I-C, which are chips that are specifically designed, optimized for minting cryptocurrency. And now some cryptocurrencies are shifting from proof of work to proof of ownership almost. If you own a lot of crypto coins, you can mint more crypto coins or operations and such. So they're moving away from the energy expensive method, even though the underpinnings of cryptocurrency are dubious at best and worthless at worst. So it's not affecting the GPUs anymore. That's the thing. Now there's absolutely no demand for cryptocurrency minters for GPUs. It's only the gamers and PC people, and the price seems to be artificially raised for a higher demand than anyone has. And in the old days of a year or two ago, it was very difficult to buy a high-end graphic processor board. If you went to any of the usual retail stores, websites, you would see that there were none in stock. Now, all these things are all in stock. There is absolutely no lack of supply, probably, again, because they priced the units too high, and they spec'd them in a strange way that wasn't exactly what the consumer really probably wanted or needed. So it's a complicated thing. I always try my best to add some healthy skepticism. It's the job of these guys to market and rah-rah their product. That's how they make their money, but it ain't how I make my money, so I can afford to be somewhat healthy skepticism, which I apply liberally.
I think you're really nice and have a great point of view, but I must say there was a few examples that these guys put out that I thought were somewhat noteworthy, and one of them was that apparently they're doing so much number crunching that they're able to actually replace things. So they gave this example that it took a PhD person that had access to equipment and stuff inside a university setting to be able to develop the ability to talk about how one, like, protein folds up. And then by using the compute, they were able to, like, train whatever they did and were able to do thousands of these things in a year. And so they were multiplying the one person's five-year commitment against hundreds of thousands of these various, things. And wow, it was like years and years of stuff done in 1 year in terms of the advancement of biology. So I don't know. I thought that was astounding.
Well, once again, I don't have anything inherently against NVIDIA. They're a business. They have, they have a bottom line. They decide what profit is something they should go for. Their technology is above reproach. They're the bleeding edge of this type of technology. It's kind of unfortunate. AMD kind of has fallen behind. It too sells graphic processor boards, but I don't think that they compare completely with NVIDIA. Intel has begun to design their own graphics boards. They're taking little baby steps before they can run. So I look forward to what the future versions of those will be. So I think NVIDIA is a very smart company with very smart engineers and very smart products. I think they're promoting mostly, I could be wrong, the A100 board series. So that's the commercial server version of these extreme AI processors. I look forward to future developments. I don't want to make it sound as though I'm disparaging the company. I'm sort of disparaging some business decisions that they have made. I think they're a great technical company, but, not always great technical companies are great business companies for the consumer.
We never knew we needed IBM until there was an IBM PC. Listen, there's something else I think has come up. You brought up shortages. I tried to buy a Raspberry Pi, and that was ridiculous. They're not out there, and it's just amazing that those little computers aren't even available now.
Well, you shouldn't really just disparage it as a little computer. I was just playing with one of my few Raspberry Pis the other day. I had a problem installing Influx, which is a DB application, because anyone who is familiar with Raspberry Pis and the way that Linux works, there are repositories where you get applications, and the repositories sometimes have authentication keys, and sometimes the people in charge change the authentication keys but don't include it in the repository, and so you're left with a program that won't install because it doesn't have a proper authentication key. But nevertheless, Raspberry Pis, the chipsets are very scarce. They've been very successful. And when TSMC and the other foundries kind of got screwed up during COVID, they were one of the many companies involved. And so sometimes you can get a Raspberry Pi for twice the price it used to go for, and sometimes you can't even get it at that. They're very scarce. Some people are turning to clones and knockoffs. Some are better than others. Eventually, I'm sure the foundries will catch up. The chips will be manufactured. If anything, probably 4 or 5 years down the road, there will be a glut of foundries out there that will be capable of manufacturing solid-state chipsets. And prices will probably plummet for a while. And then some companies will probably mothball some of the excess foundries that they have started to build in the last few years during the silicon crunch, if you will. So it's another weird business cycle of boom and bust. Thankfully, it hasn't affected memory chip prices. I don't think they ever really went terribly high, and now they're even lower, and there's more denser chips available. You can get a SD card that has a terabyte on it, which amazes me to this day. I've told everyone probably here stories of when I first saw a 2 megabyte hard that was going for $2,000 back in the 1980s.
TV. Well, I think that one thing is that the Raspberry Pis are supposed to come back in about 6 months, and it seems like it takes a long time to get that stuff online. But when they do come online, I bet it's going to be in a big way, because they say that they're satisfying the orders of industrial customers first. And it is, and you can get them, but they're double. But I was wondering, do you think that they're counterfeit? Do you think it's a really a genuine product that you're getting for twice the price from Amazon, for instance?
Well, I don't know for sure. AC2GS, by the way. You know, unfortunately, cloning chips is very, very, very common. So at the, you know, it's possible that they're clone chips. I haven't really read much of anyone accusing Amazon of that, although Amazon has gotten real loose with thumb drives. There were a large number in the Alibaba and AliExpress and such where you could buy things that said they were terabytes worth of memory on a thumb drive, and what they were was something like 16 gigabytes, and someone had changed the controller chip programming to incorrectly read terabytes of memory. That was not a problem with Amazon up until maybe about 6 months ago. And little by little, I've heard people getting robbed from third-party Amazon marketplace people doing that. So the bottom line is, I do not know. There's a lot of labeled clones. There's something called Orange, which is uses similar chipsets. And maybe one-to-one. I haven't really investigated it that much. I have I have really just about three full functioning Raspberry Pis. I have one that is built into a keyboard, and I have two Raspberry 4Bs, and I have one of those little Pico board Raspberry Pis as well that I play around with. I'll wait until they get a supply and the prices go back down to something reasonable.
They sell, I think they call it Raspberry Pi 400, the board things. So do you have one of those? It's like a white keyboard with a red base, and it has like ports at the back. Do you think that's a good deal?
If you can get it at a right price, yeah, I think it's a nice little thing. You could kind of use it as a mini PC. I have a small LCD monitor that is touch capable that I could plug into that keyboard, and it's like having your own little extra PC. I even bought a small LCD that can kind of be tacked onto the board itself. To give you a very small display. You kind of need a magnifying glass to make out all the characters. So I don't utilize it as much as I do the small LCD touch monitor that I bought to play around with. But yeah, I found it endlessly amusing. But I've used both. They have different purposes. I have some Raspberry Pis that I use for Pi hole, and I use to do a speed test on my network ISP provider. So it wouldn't make sense to use something like that with the keyboard. So those go on to the 4B, and they're kind of dedicated for those little micro server functions.
I think that's really cool. One question, those monitors that you're talking about, is the one that's so small like a 7-inch monitor, and then the other one with the touchscreen must have been at least like a 14-inch, or what were the sizes of the monitors?
I don't recall exactly. I think that it's something like either a 10 or a 12-inch diagonal is the large one, and the small one that just kind of plugs in the side of the Raspberry Pi board is a very small one. I think it's something like 4 inches.
I agree. 4 inches is real small. I have about, I don't know, 6 or 8 of them, something like that. But I wanted to get one of the newer ones because I did it for a while, and a totally different level, and it didn't have the capabilities it has now. So I thought, oh, I'll get a new one, and then they're not available. So I don't know, threes and fours. I mean, I was back at two. I think that it's the keyboard thing sounds great to me, and I was thinking of getting one. So I'm hoping that it's going to work out. And anyway, I'm glad to know you gave it a plug.
Yeah, I think that they'll be back. I mean, they might even give you an upgrade version. You know, you never know when they'll let out the Raspberry Pi 5. But you know, the keyboard is nice to fiddle with if you want to play around with web browsers and do a little programming and, you know, do some active computing. Then certainly the keyboard is one less thing to deal with, because otherwise you'd need the Raspberry Pi, then you have to plug a USB keyboard into it, so this way it's two pieces become one. But again, if you're going to dedicate it to some kind of server operation where you don't even need a monitor plugged into it, my Raspberry Pi that's running on Pi-hole and Speedtest doesn't even have a monitor front end, doesn't really need one. I'll putty into it, SSH, and do whatever I need to do with the Raspberry Pi. So it's a small, self-contained device that way. So each one has its own purpose. I think you'll enjoy the 400. I did. I still continue to do that. It's more of a plaything than something to set and forget.
What I really liked about it was that I was able to use VNC and be able to get in directly into the desktop of the Raspberry Pi. And so I was able to have a number of them. I was using them in the museum for different exhibits and stuff. And I was able to keep up with them, and I was able to reach them over the Wi-Fi, and I was able to update whatever had to happen on it. If you had a display on it, I could do an update to that display and stuff like that. And so I was wondering if that same capability exists on the 4 and on the keyboard, that you could like VNC into it from a Mac, and you'll be able to pull up the desktop. And I was just wondering if you knew about that.
Yes, you can do that. I've done that. It depends on what operating system you flash into it, of course. The Raspberry Pi comes in different flavors. It comes in 32 bits, comes in 64 bits. It comes in full operating system, complete with a graphic user interface, and it takes a few clicks on the Raspberry Pi to enable remoting in, and I've done it. For the sake of my Pi-hole again and my speed test, I installed on that Raspberry Pi a headless version, so it doesn't have to deal with graphic operations, and it runs a little bit cooler, I think, and it has less demanding requirements, because I don't really need it to VNC to it. But I've used the 400 to VNC. I've used one of my Raspberry Pi 4Bs to VNC into it, and never had a problem. So you certainly should be able to.
My applications are more graphic oriented. You know, I don't really have server applications. I don't know. I guess I'm a GUI guy, because even if I had apps like that, I would still want to VNC and click on things. But when you use your PuTTY and stuff like that, are you able to remember all of those commands and type them accurately every time?
Usually no. I know some of the regular ones, sudo. You know, everything ends up having to start with sudo. I know sudo update, sudo upgrade, sudo apt. I know a few of them. But when in doubt, I just Google it on my main computer. A lot of times I'll follow a directed application installments, and I'll just do a lot of cut and pasting. I am not a Linux guru. I have never claimed to be a Linux guru. They're a different type of person than me. I understand you like graphic user interfaces. I usually do too. The only thing is, though, it's sometimes it's easier if you're not really, if the end product is not a graphic display of some kind, or a graphic display on the actual Raspberry Pi. Now, I keep on mentioning the Pi hole and the speed test. It has a wonderful graphics interface as a web host. In other words, I would take my web browser on my main computer in my shack, and I URL it to that IP address at the right port, and it gives me a very nice graphic display on a web page. And I can shut Pi-hole down for a couple of minutes in case some security measure requires it. And I could play around with the displaying of data on the speed monitor. So even despite the fact that this particular Raspberry Pi doesn't have a front end, doesn't have a monitor connected to it at all times, through a web page and through the applications, it makes for pretty displays on other computers.
I don't really understand what Pi-hole is. Could you, like, talk about that for a minute? Victor, hey, Roy, what happened to you? Been waiting to reply. Are you out there?
KD2ZKD. I haven't heard from Roy either.
I do not know why. Okay, now it's working again. Sometimes the interface to do the push-to-talk, unfortunately, doesn't quite trigger, and it's just a software glitch with my desktop. So hopefully you're hearing me now. Again, I'll try again. Do you hear me now?
AC2ZV, yes.
Okay. It just didn't trigger. So now I just had to click it a few times until it remembered what it was supposed to do. A Pi-hole is sort of a DNS server and a firewall. So what it does is it takes the packets and checks to make sure that ad services aren't going through. So it blocks some of the ads. Also, it will record the way that a DNS server is a dynamic name server, and you always pipe into your network instructions for each of your computers which dynamic net server name server you want to use. The name server will decode, say, Microsoft.com and give you the IP address, 3.12.140.2. This implementation of Pi-hole will operate as its own little DNS server. If it has a name that it doesn't recognize, it'll go out to a real name server and get the numbers. But once it has the numbers, it will keep using them internally. So in other words, if I keep hitting on Microsoft.com, 10 times an hour, it would only go out to an outside DNS server once. The rest of the time, it would do the translation internally. So it's a nice ad blocker, and you can adjust it and block more ad sites or less ad sites, and you can disable it for 10 minutes or 5 seconds or what have you.
I like that idea. I got a software version of that called Little Snitch, and it really screwed up my computer, and it took me a while to get it to turn off. And so I think having an external device may be a better plan, because then it would work on a network level rather than just on one machine.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea. I have there are some belt and suspenders guys who have two Pi holes, and they use the second one as the backup version, because a lot of operating systems allow you to give it two DNS servers. So they'll put the first Pi hole as the first DNS server, and the second one is the second DNS server. I just use another DNS server as the backup. If my pie hole fails, then I'll just get some extra ads from a generic DNS server out in the internet. But I think it's a nice little thing. I have all of my iPads connected to it, my iPhone connected to it, my computer's connected to it. So it makes life relatively easier. And if I want to get more stringent, I could add more parameters. I could add whitelists. I could add blacklists and tweak and adjust it to my heart's content. So it's a very nice application. For those people out there who have network-attached storage, can probably have it run on that type of a server as well. But you know, it was just easier for me to manage it on a Raspberry Pi, and it gave me an opportunity to play around a little bit with the technology.
So it doesn't actually go through it because there's only one Ethernet jack on the Raspberry Pi. So I would think that to use that, you have to basically set your DNSs on your machines to the to your unit and to your Pi hole, and then the Pi hole itself would have to have a DNS server, because if it didn't know, it'd have to go to know where to go, right?
Exactly. Yeah, now I'm transferring. That's the way it exactly works. The Pi hole has a DNS server listed. It goes to Cloudflare, which is has an IP DNS that's incredibly easy to remember, 1.1.1.1. If it doesn't recognize the name that I give it, if it's already looked it up, it records it in its memory and pulls it out again and doesn't have to go to Cloudflare. And all of my computer equipment has listed as the DNS server, the local IP address of my Raspberry Pi. So that's how it's all directed to that. It has a backup DNS server, which is the Cloudflare 1.1.1.1. Just in case the Raspberry Pi fails or something, it will just simply move on to the next DNS server that is located out there in the clouds.
Well, thanks for telling me about the Cloudflare 1.1.1.1. I was using 8.8.8.8 as one of the backups on machines. I was just setting up to see if they work and stuff like that. But one of the questions I had about how that thing works is, usually when I go to a website, it goes in here and then it goes to tracking.blah blah blah, and I can't really see what that is, but I see that it goes there and it goes to a redirect site and it goes to another site, and then the browser goes HOF, COF, CHOKE, and then I get downloaded a page. So are you saying that you could kind of skip all the redirect BS and go directly to a source, even if it's a source like a newspaper or something that's changing daily?
Well, the source's material is changing daily, but its IP address is, most companies have static IP addresses. It's only us poor customers that don't get offered static IP addresses. We get dynamic IP addresses that we usually have the same dynamic IP address for a month or two. It's very rare that even the dynamic IP addresses that change. But as far as DNS servers are concerned, it's just the IP address that's the important thing that's stored. The web pages are all on the web servers, and it sort of depends upon what web page you go to. Some web pages are just direct HTML information, and you see it. But a lot of them are much more sophisticated, and they take you to other pages. They load other pages in information from other pages in different areas. That's what partially the ad blocker attempts to do. When the web page kind of starts to be read and it's then sent off with other IP addresses, if those IP addresses are on the blacklist, you'll get a blank ad instead of some animated nonsense that takes up too much of the screen. So it sort of depends upon the web server and how they've written the pages. If they've written simplified, it should load as one thing. But a lot of times it's fragmented and it calls a whole bunch of Javas and other source material.
Okay, that's really great. I like the idea between describing those pages as simplified and Javaed as two different descriptions, because I've seen that a number of times. So it sounds like what's going to happen is that I would be able to put that at the network level, like between, or maybe, I don't know exactly where it would go in my LAN, but it would probably go behind, like I've got an internet router that goes to my router, and then I'd have to put it behind my router on my network, not in the DMZ. Or do you put it in the DMZ?
Gee whiz. Didn't kind of trigger again. I don't know how much was lost, but just trying to retrace my steps, you should be able to not have to do the DMZ thing. It should work fine. It's just going out to another DNS server, which your ISP provider should allow you. Some ISP providers are wonky with ports. And I was going on and on, I guess, too much about a VPN and that I needed to use one just to do what I'm doing tonight, because if I try to log on with my AC2GS account as the same time that I'm using this KC2RC-R account, Echo Link writes me nasty email saying you shouldn't do that with the same IP address. So I needed to provide it another IP address in my house, and the easiest way to do that is to run it through a VPN.
I noticed that you were up on Echo Link, and it's working, because I like logged in just, you know, because you asked for the stay alive. But that's great to know that you can put a VPN in like that. I have the ability in my router to put up an output so that I could go, you know, do a source to a streaming server or something like that from my address, but I didn't know I could do a VPN plus that. That sounds pretty sophisticated. Is that like standard feature, or is that just something you downloaded onto your computer and that tunneled through all the way to the other side?
Let's see if I got it. Okay. It seems to be a little erratic tonight, this little system. Anyway, this is a separate service. There are a lot of VPN companies. I happen to use Private Internet Access, PIA. I've used them for years. They're relatively inexpensive. Thankfully, VPNs are not terribly expensive, and they let you get around all kinds of interesting things. So I use an outside VPN as opposed to an internal VPN. You're using an internal VPN that has other benefits. You can tunnel in and provide a private network for trusted people that doesn't leave any openings for hackers to get at. But this is a slightly different one. This is an external VPN. I tunnel out from my computer instead of through the ISP. It puts an encrypted packet that goes over to private internet access servers. They decrypt it, and then they create the IP address for me. So that's how that works. There are other facilities also for tunneling in. I have an alternative. The way that I do the Icecast, where I alias the audio streams of our repeater KC2RC and the other repeater W2VL, is through a port forward opening on my router, which is not the most secure way. So I have a backup available to me. I'm running Cloudflare, also allows for free tunneling. So I have tunnels that open outward without that port forwarding flaw in the router as a backup option to get out the audio stream without opening up some of my ports to hackers.
So much great information. Like, I've been wondering about all this kind of stuff and don't know who to talk to. But let me ask you another question about the pie hole. is the system such a thing that you feel that you actually get a benefit in terms of your speed as you're clicking around online? You don't have to wait for the delay of going to the server and getting the thing back and forth and all that three-way handshake. It basically kills that process, and then you get a much quicker response time.
I think it kind of goes back to your mileage might vary. It really depends upon the sites that you go to and how they're configured. I wouldn't recommend the pie hole inherently for speeding up the way that you deal with the internet. Its primary major feature to me, the internal DNS is just a little extra ribbon on the bow. Type of a thing. Primary reason that I used it is to block a bunch of annoying ads. I almost forgot what it was like to not have animated things dancing around on the side of my web pages. So that's my primary reason for the pie hole. The DNS addition is just a little extra.
Do you think if I was watching like YouTube on my computer, I could block the ads that are coming in from YouTube by using that device?
I don't know, but I would tend to doubt it. Those are kind of embedded into YouTube for obvious reasons. They tack it onto the roll itself. So it's not that they're just kind of flashing some window off on the side. They're really kind of forcing you to see that revenue-making ad. I just buy Prime YouTube, whatever it's called, so that I don't have the ads. And God forbid if the guys in the YouTube are trying to run an inside ad, I just hit the fast-forward button.
Inside ads in those YouTube, but I like watching them all the same, and I just do the same thing. I pop right through, but sometimes I like to say, well, let's hear about Brilliant again today. Why not? It's usually a great think about. So thanks a lot for my questions, Roy, and maybe we ought to see if anybody's out there with any more questions. So back to Net Control.
Yes, indeed. Let's try this again. I am AC2GS, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesday of every month, starting at 9 p.m. and going for as long as anyone wants it to go. And we still have our puzzle for this this TechNet to talk about. But before that, if anyone has any questions or topic for discussions tonight, feel free, hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, I take that as no more questions. So let's pull out the old puzzle for tonight. It's not that difficult, I think. You do need to look at it, though. It's the March 22nd, since this is March 22nd, TechNet puzzle. There's a schematic, there's a drawing, and there's a little X marks the spot for one of the components in the circuit. And it's a reasonably simple question. It simply asks, what is the component labeled X in the diagram? And you have four choices, A, B, C, and D. A is ferrite bead, B is variable resistor, C is varicap diode, and D is radio frequency choke. So if there's anyone out there who is able to pull up the illustration from the TechNet puzzle for March 22nd, all you have to do is type in puzzle.kc2rc.com. And if you have any ideas what that component is marked with an X, feel free. Well, it shouldn't really be that difficult, so I'm assuming that some people are just not near their computer or their cell phone, and others, hopefully, are rushing to their computer or cell phone and typing in puzzle.kc2rc.com and looking at the illustration. So they'll hopefully be able to answer the question. So once again, this is AC2GS with the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net with the TechNet puzzle for March 22nd. If anyone has any thoughts on the subject, please feel free to hit that push-to-talk button.
This is This is AC2ZB. Hey, Roy, why don't you just give us another hint and tell us what the circuit is trying to do? And that may be a dead giveaway, but although that the text does give away a little bit, but I think you should give us the purpose of this circuit, and then maybe somebody will get an idea and want to respond.
Well, I don't think you really need to know the you know, I mean, there are tuned circuits, there are variable resistors, there's all kinds of fun passive type of components. There's a tuned network at the bottom, there is a coupling capacitor and inductor, and there's a variable resistor. You know, it's just a kind of an excuse to see if people kind of know what that symbol means, because it's a little unusual. It looks, you know, sort of like a capacitor, but also sort of like a diode. So, you know, that's probably a good hint of what this thing might be.
Yeah, I totally agree with you on that. I don't know what the symbol for a ferrite bead might look like. But maybe that would be just a circle around the wire. I don't know. Anyway, maybe somebody wants to guess, or you want me to guess?
Maybe.
Well, I'll throw it out to the rest of the audience. We'll give it a 10, 15-second count, and if no one replies, then I guess it's up to you, William.
KD2MVP, I'll take a guess.
Okay, Bob?
Well, I was thinking of this anyway. It was sort of like a diode or part of a diode, so I just was guessing very capped diode. That's my guess.
Okay, very good. It is, in fact, a varicap diode. We've talked about them before. They have other names. Some people call them varactors. They are voltage-controlled capacitors. The idea is, as you change the voltage potential, the semiconductor interacts and the capacitance changes. So it's a sort of electronically adjustable variable capacitor. And again, they're either called varicap diodes or varactors. So that's the answer for tonight.
ZV. So what do you think the symbol for a ferrite bead is?
Well, probably a ferrite bead is basically just an inductor with a core. So it would be the inductor symbol with a core. I think it's either two or three straight lines in parallel with the core schematic, that, showing you that it does have a non-air core to it.
That's probably exactly correct. You know, I was thinking that kind of symbol is used for actually a wire-wound coil, whereas a ferrite bead is actually just something that clips on the outside of the wire. So I was wondering if a circle around the wire had ever been used to show locations of ferrite beads, but I don't know. I think that it would be cumbersome to write baby inductors, like you say, but I've never seen that symbol anywhere, and that's what it sparked my curiosity. So that's why I asked the question.
You have to keep in mind the fact that all straight wires are inductors. They do not have a great number of Henrys. They don't have a great deal amount of inductance or reactance. But any straight piece of wire has some degree of inductance. And by applying a clamp around it, you're effectively adding a ferrite core to it and increasing its minuscule inductance to a much higher level. So as far as the physics are involved, it's a inductor. So again, I would suggest that you would simply use the symbol of an inductor with a core, making the difference. You know, every straight wire connection is effectively a inductor, and at very high frequencies, nearby wires are capacitors, and that's what gives RF engineers all their headaches.
Yeah, I totally agree. I was just trying to come up with a novel way of picturing it in my mind. And you're totally right. So thanks a lot, Roy.
Well, you're welcome, William, as always. So we've done our little puzzle for tonight. And it's 10:11, so it certainly wouldn't be unusual to call it a night. But if anyone has any further questions or comments to make tonight before we call it a night, hit that push-to-talk button and tell us what's on your mind.
KD2NVP, I just have another question about one of the other symbols that I don't remember seeing before, wondering what it is.
Sure. What symbol would that be? It's going to be kind of difficult, I guess, to point it out, but give it a try.
It'd be pretty easy to describe. It's the one it looks sort of like squiggly, like a resistor, but it doesn't touch the thing on the very top. It has an arrow pointing at it. I was just curious what that is.
That is a potentiometer or a variable resistor. You know, it's those old knobs that used to be in all the machines that, audio and radio and other such before optical selectors became a big thing and everything was central CPU operated. But it's simply a resistor on either a linear taper or a logarithmic taper that has a third a portion that is adjustable. So you turn a knob, the contact shifts from one side of the resistive material to the other side of the resistive material.
Okay. You know, when I was studying for tests, and I just don't look at schematics a lot, I probably knew that at one time long enough to... I just didn't remember that one. Are there some other symbols for variable resistors, or is that... that's the main one that people use?
Well, that's the primary one. I'm sure that there are unusual ones. In England, they don't seem to use the same schematics as in the United States. And you might have noticed it because sometimes I borrow diagrams from the UK. Last time we had a TechNet puzzle, it had some resistors drawn in a UK schematic in which they're little rectangles instead of the ones that I'm showing you tonight where they're squiggly lines.
A 2D crude drawing of a resistor, you know, a flattened version of the way the resistor looks like, I suppose.
Yes, yes. William, you wanted to say something?
Roy, this is AC2ZV. I have a little comment. Usually, when I see the resistor symbol, it's usually connected to one of the points. And this is like a different symbol than I've seen, that I remember seeing, because I usually see it connected. So it looked a little different than normal to me. So is that a British symbol, or is that something... you know, that's standard to you, and I'm just not remembering things correctly?
It's pretty standard to me. How would you draw a variable resistor? The idea is that it's kind of symbolic for a center wiper on a strip of somewhat resistive material. So the wiper is the little arrow point. I guess theoretically you could draw it a little closer or a little farther away, but the way that I learned it was a resistor with the zigzags and the center pad is a little arrow in the middle, and you make the connections through that. You have, you know, if you're doing some kind of a voltage divider thing, you have voltage on one side, you have ground on the other side, and then depending upon how you move the variable resistor, potentiometer, rheostat, you get a different voltage potential as a voltage divider circuit.
C2ZV. Well, I guess the thing I'm commenting on is that typically I wouldn't have a leading resistor, you know, that close, maybe because of proximity and the size of the diagram, it was necessary to do that. But the first little zigzag in the front, the resistor that feeds the wiper of the variable resistor, is somebody controlling within the image. And so I would have had either the plus with the ground farther away, or I would have pointed the grounds down by themselves and done it differently totally. But for this image, you know, it probably works, and, you know, I could read it correctly. But as for more traditional schematics that I've seen, there would be a longer straight line going up into as the wiper arm. And so just the way the image is presented, I thought, was unusual. But, you know, it's just me looking at things weirdly.
Yeah, I understand. You got to keep in mind that this is for kind of teaching benefits. This is probably not something that you would see in the schematic diagram for a piece of equipment that engineers were working on, but you never know. I mean, they've tidied things up a great deal. There's software that does all kinds of schematics. Some of them are rather expensive. Some of them are bundled with a PC board creation software, so they give it away for free with the idea that you'll use the schematic to generate a PC board, and you'll send them the design, and they'll turn it around and sell you some finished PC boards. So, it's not the prettiest picture, I guess, but, you know, it serves the purpose, especially since the point of the exercise was the varactor, not really the potentiometer / rheostat.
I know what the point was, but I like looking at the drawings all the time. I think the thing is, it looked to me somewhat esoteric, as if maybe there was an antenna that was leaping across the air gap, because usually there's a long straight line, and it does usually connect, I think, to the resistor with a point on it. I'll have to go back and look at other schematics to see, but it just looked unusual, and so I thought it was a very interesting diagram, and it adds now to my vocabulary of electronic diagrams to read.
I think if it had a point on it, it would be more of a tapped resistor than a wiper. I think the arrow aspect is usually made to denote a wiper type of a function, whereas if it was a little dot contact, it would be a fixed tap in some portion of the resistor, in the same way that you have a similar dot when you have a tapped transformer center.
But in my image, it still has an arrow on it. The arrow didn't go away. So the arrow is still there. So it's just for just a three-pin diagram of what that potentiometer usually looked like, there's a direct connection to the center of the potentiometer and a resistor that goes around the end, and that center wiper goes around that resistor with no resistance coming in. And it's all connected somehow all the time, and it's always like tapped, you know, but it's variable tapped. So anyway, I appreciate it. And thanks a lot for showing us the TechNet and hosting the TechNet tonight.
Okay, very good. William, we let the repeater ID itself too, so that's nice. So once again, right before I call it a night, just open it up. If anyone else out there has any questions or comments to make before we close it down for tonight, this is probably the best time for you to say it, because otherwise I'll just have the closing comments and wish you well. Very well. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York, and we meet on the first Wednesday of each and every month. Our next meeting will be April 5th, which will be held by teleconference. We also will be doing a little hybrid meeting in which William, AC2ZV, allows a certain number of people to come to his Microtech museum. And they're hooked up via Zoom to the rest of us, all usually sitting in our houses, my shack, with Zoom on, and we'll meet. Club members will be emailed with the details of logging into the meeting using Zoom. People interested in contacting William can find the information on the front page of our website. Non-members wishing to join a general meeting can email me, AC2GS, with some form of identification for the required link. Although our meetings informally begin after 7 p.m., our formal regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues anywhere from 8:30 to 9:30, sometimes 10 o'clock, depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each and every month at 9 p.m. We also sponsor a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 o'clock a.m. on 28.380 upper sideband or nearby, depending upon people operating on that frequency. We don't kick them off. We move to the right or the left. We offer an audio stream of our KC2RC repeater on the Internet as well as our 10-meter net. Type into your browser stream.kc2rc.com. and it'll give you the audio stream. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. If you would like to contact the host of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website hosting services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, Three Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. It's time to roll this all up and shut it all down, but we'll be back on April 12th. To do it all over again. Thanks to everyone who participated tonight, and especially my co-host, Bob, KD2NVB. Without you guys, I'd just be talking to myself. So, this is Roy, AC2GS, going clear and getting the heck out of here. Have a great time, stay safe, be well, and we'll talk again down the line. This is AC2GS, clear.